Hey guys, welcome to episode 48 of the JV Club. I am recording this intro from San Francisco, still here looking towards the third and final weekend of SF Sketchfest. Guys, I'm not going to lie to you, I am exhausted. That is certainly true. I can only imagine how my partners and the rest of our staff feel. We are so lucky to have such an extraordinary group of people working on this festival. I think it has been, I'm going to categorize it as a smash hit. So far this year, and I'm really excited about our final weekend. I will have the chance to be a guest on Walking the Room with Greg Barron and Dave Anthony on Thursday, which is the day this podcast episode comes out. So when you guys listen to this tonight, listen, I'm assuming you crack this episode open the day it airs. For those of you who are catching up, I mean, you're wildly out of date. By the time you guys listen to this, I will have already done Walking the Room with Greg Barron and Dave Anthony. But I'm very excited about that. And then on Saturday night, doing theme park improv with my improv group. Very, very excited to see all those guys. That show is sold out. And then a Burning Love panel on Sunday, which I think might also be sold out. But if not, and you're listening to this, give her a whirl. Try, come see the show. That's a really, really cool panel of people from both seasons one and two of Burning Love. Before I get into shout outs, I just wanted to explain really quickly that this episode with Lynn Shay was one that I recorded quite a long time ago. It is before I started doing MASH. You'll actually hear me make a reference to June Raphael, and that should give you an indication of how long ago it was that I recorded this episode. So don't be surprised if you don't hear any of the games you've come to know and hopefully love. Lynn has really led an extraordinary life. She's been in a ton of great movies, some of my favorites. There's Something About Mary and Kingpin. She's also done some really fine dramatic acting. I'm sure you'll recognize her if you look at her picture on the Nerdist page or on our Facebook page. And she's just a really amazing woman. So I hope you guys enjoyed the episode. And then I also wanted to give shout outs. I guess I promised that moments ago. Here we go. Nissa M via email, Veronica C via email, via the Facebook page, Joshana, Jenny S., Aaron S., Jamie M., Deborah, Georgie, Karen B., and Aida on the Twitter. These are shout-outs from on the Twitter. NTR, Zaxi, Cats Meow, Megan C., Maria Josella, or Josela. I'm not sure, Maria, but this is definitely a shout-out, so enjoy it. Cassidy Ellis, Stephanie G., Ken F., Lou, Mrs. Davenport, and Sylvia R. And then I just wanted to also quickly say that the live podcast with Tig Notaro that happened last Saturday was one of my favorite experiences on a stage ever in my life. I cannot thank Tig enough for doing it. I'm so excited to release the episode. I think it's really, really, really great, and the audience was absolutely terrific. I also want to give very special shout outs to Gabe, who came from out of town to see the show and several other Sketchfest shows. And he also made some very cool JV Club pins. And I still have some buttons left. So if anybody wants a button, send me a message on the Facebook page and I'll get them out to you. They're really, really cute. And then Russell came and gave me a Lucy Maud Montgomery first edition book. I'm still completely stunned and so honored to have received. And then my own Victoria Eden, who runs our JV Club podcast Twitter account, was there in person, and it was such a joy to get to meet her in person. So what a great experience, guys. And I look forward to releasing the episode. I think it's going to come out next week, possibly the week after, but probably next week. Okay, guys, without further ado, I will give you Lynn Shay.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I am here with one of my heroes. Her name is Lynn Shay, and she is an actress that you have seen in so many things. It's almost silly to start listing them off. I think we can probably acknowledge that There's Something About Mary is sort of one of the most ubiquitous in terms of like a huge movie and a hugely memorable character. But you were also in Kingpin. Right. You were in Insidious. And you have the chops to do absolute crazy comedy and then really, really subtle, serious, dramatic performances as well.
Thank you, Janet.
And you've been doing this for quite some time with much success.
Well, you know, success is a relative word. I have been doing it a really long time. I've always loved it. I never knew it was a real profession until I finished college and I thought, what am I going to do with myself? And I was an art history major at University of Michigan. And I thought, well, I could go work in a museum. And I was always in theater there and always in theater in high school. As a matter of fact, we just had a high school reunion and someone sent me photographs of our high school auditorium. It's Mumford High School in Detroit, which is being torn down. It was always called the Pink and Blue School. And that's a tragedy for me because it was like this deco, really amazing building. And when I saw the pictures, it was crazy because I did get a little twinge of those were some of my first early, you know, theatrical endeavors. Mr. Matthews was my, what was his first name? I can't think of it. Earl Matthews.
Earl Matthews.
This handsome guy with sort of a gray salt and pepper crew cut who we all had crushes on. And he was our sort of acting coach and directed a lot of the plays. And it was a great memory to see those photos. I was surprised of my emotional reaction, actually.
I bet.
So it's been, I have been doing this to spill the beans. I got my equity card in at the Chelsea Theater Center in New York City in 1971. So it's been 40 years this year
that
I became a professional actor. And I did go to, after Michigan, I enrolled at Columbia University in their theater arts department, which was just a new department at the time. And it was a fabulous experience. It was 3 years of nonstop theater school. Actually, I had forgotten. I was also accepted to NYU. And I, you know how you always remember the things you didn't get into?
Yeah.
Well, I actually found my acceptance letter the other day that I think my dad had saved for me in this little file. I was looking for some stuff. And I thought,
it's not too late, Lynn. Yeah. It's not too late.
Maybe I better go.
Dust that off and head on back to NAU.
But anyway, so.
Well, let's go back to Mumford for a second, to Mumford High and Detroit. And so you tell me just a little bit about your family, if you don't mind. What was it like and who'd you have?
Who did I have?
Who'd you have?
I grew up in the house I lived in all my life until I went to college. So that was a wonderful house. I lived on Fairfield, which was in sort of the northwest section of Detroit. It wasn't really a suburb yet, but it was a residential area, a beautiful tree lined with elm trees, actually. The whole street was like this cathedral of elm trees, which unfortunately caught elm disease over the course of the time I lived there, and they were all cut down. And I remember how terrifying it was to have the sun pouring in on everybody because we always had this beautiful shady street. It was a beautiful home. My mom was a homemaker. She was, and my dad was in the wholesale grocery business. But also, both my parents, when I think about it, were real artists in their own right. My mom had a great sense of personal style and
nice.
A beautiful home. It wasn't like an expensive kind of home. It was more just very tasteful. And she loved the fact that she was a true lady. She was originally born in Russia and came to this country at 13 years old, put into the first grade at 13 years old, not speaking a word of English.
Whoa.
And I remember she used to tell me her knees, she couldn't even get her knees under the desk because it was made for kids that were six, and 7 years old. And she graduated from high school at 17 years old, speaking perfect English. She never had a trace of an accent, and was apparently like this wild typist and got a job as a social worker in the Detroit sociology. What would you call it? So the social work system.
Right, the social work system. I guess that is what you would call it.
And then she met my father shortly when she was, I guess, in her, my dad was 25, she was 23. And she was wildly in love with my dad. There's wonderful, great stories from my mom, who I've been thinking of often lately with a lot of emotion.
And you showed me some beautiful photos of her as we were looking at photos together.
Yeah, maybe that's why. I've been kind of searching for some things the last couple of weeks and have found some fabulous photographs that really trace sort of a lot of her history. And which is this part of my history, obviously.
Sure.
But anyway, she was, when she married my dad, he was he had graduated from law school at 21 years of age. I had some smart parents, I'll tell you.
I guess so.
I have big shoes to fill. I feel like they really were both very, very smart in everything they did, really. But my mom, so she gave up working pretty much when they got married. My dad and his two brothers and father had a small wholesale grocery business called Grosse Pointe Quality Foods. As traditional at that time, you know, it was 2 years later, my mother got pregnant with my brother, and 4.5 years later after that, she had me. And so we were sort of the classic 50s family,
nuclear
really.
Family, yeah.
And
I was just going to say, did you get along with your brother?
My brother was the classic older brother. He was so mean to me, and I always wanted to be around him. Of course, that was the problem.
Aww.
Is that I tagged after him, and there weren't a lot of kids in our neighborhood. We lived in a there were not very many children. Which led me to spending a lot of time by myself.
Mm.
And I sometimes think had to do with my early desire to be an actor.
Sure.
I spent a lot of time in my room by myself, and I would try on all the clothes in my closet. I would empty my whole closet on the floor and make up stories with my animals, my stuffed animals, and my dolls.
Yeah.
And act them out. I had these two long mirrors on French doors in my bedroom. It was like a big open closet with two doors that opened. And I vividly remember just making up stories, and it would be like a serial. Like at the end of the day, I would throw all the clothes back on the floor, of course, much to my mother's chagrin. And but I would sort of pick up the next day where I left off. And so I think that was kind of my early beginnings of theater in a way.
Oh, it absolutely was. There's no question about it. And then so in school. I know you did it in high school. Did you do it? Were there good arts classes when you were really young, or was it something that became available to you in high school?
There was nothing that was. It was just
curriculum.
As typical of most kids. You know, my first part was as an Indian in the Thanksgiving play, where my mother bought me a long sleeve brown turtleneck, so I looked like I had dark skin.
And the little
band with the feather we got, and of course I was sick and never got to do it anyway. Oh, you did ask me a question I didn't answer, which was about my brother.
Well, you said that he was a classic older brother who kind of gave you a hard time.
And he had a locked top drawer to his desk that drove me wild.
Oh, I bet.
I used to sit in his room when he wasn't there, just looking at the drawer.
I knew
I'd never get in there, but honestly, I would just sit there and sort of like, just sit and look at it, because I knew there was something in there that I must want.
You. Did you ever find out what was in there?
I think he had a coin collection, and probably some naked women.
I mean, I guess that's what I was getting at.
Girls.
Like, the chances are probably there might have been one or two.
But I think it was more the coin collection he kept, but I never really asked him. I never really told him either.
Yeah,
now
you didn't
knows.
Tell him that you just sat and fixated
on the drawer.
So what were you like as a young teenager when you're 14 going into high school? Paint us a picture of what was important to you, and kind of how you fit into the social structure of the school. Did you have a ton of friends? Did you have a few close friends? Were you lonely?
I remember my early years at school, I had just one friend that was my best friend. And I didn't really have a lot of friends. And I remember kind of befriending, there was I think she was mentally disabled, actually, and I loved her. I just thought she was the nicest person in the world, and everybody was mean to her. And I actually, this is something I feel good about to this day. I was really her friend. I was like her only friend, and her name was Pamela. And she always had these rosy, rosy cheeks, and she kind of had a slurred speech. She didn't really speak very well.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't do well in school. You know, she was always failing stuff and everything. It's crazy when you think about that, that they didn't do anything to try to really help her. And there was always the popular kids. And I never felt I was part of that at all. By the time I was in eighth grade, it was a little clubbier. I remember sort of, but I always felt on the outside. I mean, no matter what. And on some level, I still do.
I feel the same way.
It's like, I think that's something, I always think of myself on the outer edge of the circle. I never think of myself or have the desire to be in the middle of the circle. And that's something, people are different about that. I think there are people who really want to be in the middle, and that's the way they have a sense of comfort and security. And mine is, I think I always see myself alone. And for better or for worse, you know, maybe we all are alone, really. And I'm comfortable with that. And it wasn't in the eighth grade. I remember there was a club called the Coquettes.
Oh, my.
There was the Premieres and the Coquettes.
Oh, this is marvelous.
Well, I wasn't in the Premieres.
Oh.
I couldn't get in.
And it was just like something that the girls, that they themselves created.
Yeah.
It was just a little social circle, like, I'm just going to put this into a Grease reference because it's fun. The Pink Ladies.
Yeah.
Got it.
So the Premieres, I wasn't in. The Coquettes, we were sort of the second classes. You know.
I think the Coquettes, although they, I mean, you can't be first if the Premieres are around. They've named themselves as the first and best.
We were not the popular girls.
But the Coquettes sound more fun.
Well, we weren't.
Well, that's a shame.
We were the second tier, basically.
Oh, man.
But I was a Coquette. And
so what did you have to do to get into, I mean, it's so interesting because nowadays it feels like, or at least, when I was in high school, there wasn't anything that specific of a hierarchy. It was like, unless you were a cheerleader, you know, you were a part of a school organized clique, you would maybe be called, you know, then it's like, oh, you're a nerd, oh, you're one of the popular girls, or oh, you're a stoner or whatever. But to actually take the time to say, we are this is our name, right, you can't join. And like, how did you become a Coquette? What did it take?
I can't, you know, I actually don't remember.
Kill a man?
What?
I had to kill someone.
You had to kill someone. No, we did. I think we started it.
Gotcha.
I think it was like all of us were just like, we're going to be the Coquettes. It was kind of like a group of us. I remember, and I can say some of the names, but who knows, they're probably still out there.
Oh.
But there, I think Alice Fry, who is this really tall, thin, gangly girl with braces, and she's probably gorgeous, drop dead gorgeous.
That's how it happens, right?
And there was, but we were, you know, because in the other club, in the Premieres, were sort of all the really, really popular girls, you know, with the corkscrew ponytails that were perfect. There was a girl, she's also, I'm sure she's out there, named Maxine Schwartz, who was she was sort of the most popular girl in the class, or at least that's what I thought. And she probably was, but it was mostly that hair. She had this perfect, like, black, shiny hair, and it was the corkscrew in her ponytail. Her and Judy Cohen had the two best corkscrews.
The two best corkscrews!
And that was always a real bane of my existence. And I couldn't get my stupid hair to do it no matter what I did. I remember I twist it and twist it and twist it and twist it.
Yeah.
And actually, a corkscrew ponytail is really ugly.
Of course they are.
But
that's the best part of looking back and going, why was that a thing? I mean, I look at my 80s hair with my crazy braces and my bright green eyeshadow, which is funny because, of course, today I was like, I think I'm going to put on some bright green eyeshadow. I've learned nothing. I've clearly learned nothing. I made Lynn do a spit take when I described my green eyeshadow. But I had...
Just like choked on my water.
We can, you know what? We can edit all this out. I probably won't, but we can.
Oh, people want to hear me cough.
People want to hear you cough. It's the humanity, yeah, the humanity that attracts us all to each other. But you know, I had like the really straight hair. I had the hair that wouldn't do anything either. And I had super straight hair, but I did manage to get the bangs into the sort of tidal wave, but stick straight down and then a like awkwardly hairnet curly weird bundle at the top. Yeah. Why? Who decided that was the way to go? The corkscrew was gorgeous in comparison to what I just described.
Well, then we also had the DA, which was for the tough girls.
Oh.
Which was, and actually Karen Rogers, who still lives here. Her name is Karen Starr now, and we're still friends. I mean, I've seen her. She was my idol. I mean, she smoked. And mm-hmm. she like wore a collar up, and she was like a tough chick.
What's the DA? What's his DA?
The DA
stand
was
for?
Like slick back at the sides, and like the DA stands for duck's ass.
Duck's so ass. It would, like, I've heard duck tail, but I didn't know.
It was like duck's ass. That's what a DA
that's
was.
Fabulous.
And, and it was actually a guy's haircut.
Yeah.
And so they would slick back the sides and then point it in the back and make like.
And this
like
is in the 50s.
Yeah.
She had that.
Yeah.
What a badass.
So she was a badass, but she was really cute. Everybody thought Karen was she still is. She's still a darling girl. And I can only call her a girl. I still can't call her a woman.
Oh, I love it. Well, that's so much about what this podcast is for me, is that I feel so the same as I did, and my relationships to women feel the same as they did then. And that's kind of how it developed, is like, wait a minute, we're all still. That's really when I started feeling like this is the person I am, really started shaping itself when I was in high school. And for better or for worse, so much of that just stuck. I mean, I'd love to say I'm older and wiser. I guess that's probably true, but.
You know, I don't think I felt that way, though. I honestly always was very kind of self-conscious and all the way through high school.
Clown around?
No. I was not.
But you
at
did
all.
Do some
not
theater. You did, all. But you did a little bit of theater. You
I did were theater, but I was not a clown by any. I was very
demure,
somewhat shy, but not even demure. I was really kind of felt like an ugly duckling, and I remember I wore my hair straight back in a ponytail, and I had like little spit curls that were really weird. When we graduated from grade school, because we only went kindergarten through eighth, and it was with the same kids all the way up. And then we went to Mumford, which was, you know, ninth through 12th. And even in Mumford, I never, there was kind of a group of, quote, us. But I always kind of felt on the periphery. And I honestly don't feel like I came into my own. I sometimes feel like it's very recent on some levels.
I love that too, though.
It's really true. I mean, I've always defined as much as I've considered myself a loner, I would somehow always define myself against other people. And I don't do that so much anymore as I did. And it took me many, 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 many years really to get there. I even married and I have a son, and I think that was part of the problem. I was always with guys who, I don't know, I was always kind of in a shadow. I always felt like I was in the shadow of someone else. And I don't feel that anymore. I mean, it's kind of scary out there in the light.
Sure.
But I just don't, and it's partly because, you know, right now I sort of am doing my solo thing here, and it's a wonderful time for me to be doing it. But I think it took me all these years to really find that place. I didn't particularly care for high school, and I wasn't particularly happy in high school.
Yeah.
Did you had a boyfriend.
That was my next question.
No, never had a boyfriend. I always had a crush on
We know somebody. You had a crush on your drama teacher.
Yeah, I did, Mr. Matthews. But everybody loved Mr. Matthews. And he was, I hadn't thought about him. I hadn't thought about Mr. Matthews for a long time, but actually I always kind of had, it seems like I always had a crush on a guy who didn't like me back. I never went to my senior prom.
Yeah.
I wasn't invited.
And I went with girlfriends.
I don't think we did that then. It was like, if you didn't have a date,
sure,
you didn't go.
Sure.
And I remember, this was so odd, there was a girl who had me on the phone with her the whole time she was getting ready for the prom.
Oh, no.
And she was putting on her nylons and putting on her dress. And I was like, oh, and what kind of, you know, are you wearing lipstick? I mean, it was sort of sad when you think about it.
Oh, yeah. Do you think she was conscious of what she did? Was it Or was she just sincerely like, I'm going, no, I need this friend to kind of walk me through it?
She was sincere.
Yeah.
I don't think she was trying to rub my nose in anything.
Yeah.
And it was, but we weren't like, I remember, I don't know if I should say names because all these people are probably still
that
out there in the world.
Entirely up to you.
But I always wonder kind of what happened to her. She was a little fat with with freckles and kind of had.
Oh, this is your chance to talk about
now
all of those
I won't tell you
people.
Who it is. But, you know, she's pretty, she again, you know, we all listen. What you were then has nothing to do with how you turn out as a, you know, as an adult, really. I mean, your style changes, your sense of self changes. And
yeah, how was your reunion?
I didn't go to a grade school reunion, though, a couple of years ago, which was crazy to go into my grade school. Hampton School, which was, it smelled the same. It smells, and I actually went back to my old house, which I lived in until I was 18
How
years
was
old.
How was that?
It's crazy. I'd been back there one other time with my brother, and it kind of left me, because I dream about that house, and I still dream about my room in that house and my backyard, and I dream about the basement, and when we actually knocked on the door and this guy came to the door and we said, you know, we used to live here like 30 some years ago. And he says, well, come on in. The house seemed tiny for one thing.
Of course it did. Yeah, that happened to me too.
And there were a lot of change. I mean, it was nothing like my mom had it. They had, it was kind of a wreck actually. And even though it was a Tudor, beautiful Tudor house with slate roof, a really great house, a brick, you know, brick house with a slate roof. And, the backyard had a gorgeous giant oak in it that was gone and probably had died. I mean, it was an old, old, old tree. My bedroom seemed like it was like used as a storage room. It looked really shame. But going down into the same fixtures that my mother had, the same banister railing coming down the stairs, and the basement blew my mind. It was the same wallpaper that was like, it was a mustard yellow wallpaper with black French poodles on it. Really?
That's so specific.
Really. And it smelled the same linoleum. They hadn't even changed the floor.
Oh.
And it smelled exactly like, I remember there was a rec room in the basement where it was like a game room that we used to go in. You know, my mother would let us all go. That was where the kids would go and dance or whatever we were doing. And that's really all we were doing, was we were very mild. There was nothing, nothing going on other than...
Not even Karen Starr with her DA?
Karen, I probably made out with guys. But I mean, it was very, very, truly, really innocent. I mean, I'm sure, at least in my, where I grew up. I mean, it's not true everywhere. But the smell, it was like, I felt like I was on a drug.
I felt like
I was on acid or something.
Is there anything that makes us feel more strongly than an old smell, like a familiar smell?
Both my brother and I, we literally couldn't speak. We were just weeping. I mean, uncontrollably, both of us. And it was quite an experience, because it's something you very rarely get to revisit your dreams.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and that was kind of weird. When I went back to the high school, to the grade school reunion, I'm sorry I went. Because for me, some memories are better left memories. My very first love, which I have a picture of, which I'll show you.
Oh, I would love to see it.
That my brother took was my first kiss, literally. I have a picture of it. It was a fifth grade Valentine's Day party at my house. And this guy was I was so in love with him. He was my first love. And he's kissing me on the cheek. And my brother caught the shot.
It sounds like a Valentine's Day
really
card.
Is. I mean, it was like from Life magazine.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic, fantastic photo.
How amazing. Did you see him at the grade school reunion?
Oh, my goodness. I've tried to erase the whole thing from my head, because those are such formative. I know what those kids' fingernails look like. I remember how they smelled. I remember the texture of their skin. I think my memory is strongest almost from my grade school of any other time in my life.
Interesting.
And it almost ruined it for me.
Yeah.
And I honestly just kind of shut it all back out. I kind of pushed it out. Seeing the school was kind of cool, but not really. I mean, it was the same thing. I wanted to keep all those memories, real memories.
Yeah.
You know, like my, the classrooms and how they, those are still dreams I have about those corridors and getting to class and, So it wasn't fun for me. So I had no desire to go back to this other one either.
I've never gone to any of my reunions either. Although I will say the people I've kept in touch with that are still dear friends, they kind of just look the same to me. They all take great care of themselves, and they all, I don't know when we're all going to slip, but so far so
you'll
good.
Never slip.
Everybody,
you'll never slip, Janet. You should see Janet.
Oh,
she'll never slip.
That is ridiculous, because I was just about to say that to you, which is that I wish I had your physique.
Oh, please.
You are so strong. And I mean, like, this is like a boys' locker room thing.
Right,
like, do you work out?
Dude.
What's up, dude? Do you work out? Like, you got like a beautiful, beautifully toned arms. And
I've done yoga for many years. That's the truth.
That's what it is. You have a yoga body.
And I've also got genetics, you know. It's how you're, although yeah, not like my mom. I my mother and I were built completely different. She had very thin little legs. She was tiny though, also. She was like 5'1" or whatever.
And how tall are you?
5'3". Mm-hmm. And my dad was 6'1", and he had a, when he was younger, was a really extremely handsome, unbelievably beautiful guy. And he had a fantastic body. I mean, just in terms of definition. And I think I got that from my dad. You know, it's really, but again, you got to sort of take care of it. It's falling apart now, but oh well.
It's funny because first of all, no. But second of all, I think I got my dad's feet. It's so funny.
I have my
to
dad's
look
feet
you, when you look down. I mean, it's funny when you're a girl and you notice
something
like weird physical qualities about, I look much more like my dad than I do my mom. And the older I get, the more I associate looking like him, because I'm getting to the age that he was when I was, you know what I mean? Like when I was a kid. And it's a little, I mean, Dad, I'm sure you're listening to this and I love you and you're very handsome, but it is weird when you look like your father, because then I start thinking of myself as like, oh, I just look like a guy. I look like Phil.
Yeah, right.
Because you just see, you know, you kind of pick apart and see and isolate all those features.
Well,
it's
funny. Looked more like my dad. I always look like my dad. My brother looks exactly like my mother. But as I've gotten older and more life experience, I start to look exactly like my mom. So it's a real combo of the two.
But, yeah, that's true for me too, I have to say.
But I feel like I look more like my mother now than I ever did. And I just, you know, I don't know.
if you don't mind, I would love to go back, because I think a lot of women feel this way and I have felt this way. I think what you said was just so striking about the idea of choosing men or being with men whose shadows a little bit you end up feeling in. And I just think that's pervasive still.
I think we're I mean, I was sort of programmed pretty mm-hmm. much that. And my mother, who was a very independent woman in many ways, you know, sort of listening to the description of her as a little girl, being able to really get through that trauma of being a pubescent adolescent at 13 and being put with six-year-olds, how humiliating, and not understanding a word around you.
I can't
and
even
learning English in 4 years perfect. I mean, like and I'm telling you, she spoke English exactly the way I speak English.
That's
probably
amazing.
Better. Had a fabulous vocabulary. She read a lot. She was, but she was a classic. And she was very independent in many ways of my dad, and she was a real fighter for things. But there was also the sort of sociological tradition of you are the woman and he is the man and you do what he says. And she relied on my dad totally for you know, many, many, many things. I think she relied on him less emotionally than some women do.
Mm-hmm.
But she, you know, listen, she had her own issues too, which we certainly won't go into here, but things that she struggled with her mom came from Russia. When if my mom was 13 years old, her mother was a young woman and also never learned English, you know, and married an older, there's a tradition in the Jewish religion, which I was unaware of, but my mother's mother's sister was married to a man in Detroit. I still don't know how they got to Detroit. I have no idea. I've been trying to figure that out forever.
Huh.
Why everybody came to Detroit.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But they were there and someone brought them there. So, my mother's mother's sister passed away, and it was in the Jewish tradition, if your sister's has died, it's your responsibility, if you can, to marry her husband.
Yes.
So she married this older man who was like 25 or so
that
years
she,
older.
And who she knew as being her sister's husband.
And she didn't really know him very well. And he was a very stern, very cold man. Very different, according to my mother, than her real father, who had died in Russia. My real grandfather passed away. You know, he died actually of the flu epidemic in Russia.
Wow.
My mother lost two brothers and her dad to one to sunstroke in the army and the other two to the flu epidemic. So, my fun-loving grandmother, who I never met, but who my mother adored and talked about frequently when I was little, ended up marrying this very stern sort of old man. And my mother wanted to be a real American lady. That was like her goal, and she achieved it.
Yeah.
And so she did all the things that like a American lady would do. You know, she was always very well dressed. She made a lot of her own clothes, and was really, I mean, some of the things, outfits were just unbelievable. You know, little hats, and I mean, she was fantastic at all that. But I think that in the core of things, you were the woman and he's the man, and he makes the decisions and you follow pretty much what he tells you. It's the old way of doing it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that residual effect still is there. And so I kind of always put myself to the side a bit and was always a little bit angry. Because I was giving in to situations that I really maybe didn't want to give in to, but I felt it was, but I relinquished. It's like I didn't, it wasn't worth fighting for. It wasn't worth whatever. And you know what? Sometimes I still feel that way. I mean, it depends on what it is, but.
Because yeah. I'm just going to say, I mean, I think I'm going to, I hate to interrupt you, but I'm going to say what I think the listener is probably, I love that I say the listener like it's, there's one person and it's a robot. The listener. What I think is fascinating about this to me is that when I think about your performances, you know, they're so fearless and you're not afraid to be hilarious and over the top and fierce and, you know, powerful, and it's just, it's so amazing.
Let me tell you about that. acting for me is the one, well, probably the only profession I could do. The way I feel about it is this, and I've always felt this way. It's the safest place to tell the truth that you can have. I can't tell the truth in real life the way I can tell the truth on stage or on camera. Because I'm in a safe environment and I'm allowed to go as deep and as far and as creative and as crazy, whatever thread, you know, something leads me to in terms of defining a character. Where in real life, you're going to be, have repercussions. There's going to be consequences for the way you behave. In theater or in acting, your consequences are the reaction you're going to get from your partner, which is fabulous. That's what people want. They want you to challenge their character. They want you to, you know, the old fashioned thing about acting, which is, what do you want? What, you know, what's the obstacle? What's the objective? What do you want what do you want from the other person? They won't give you. How do you get it? What do you do to get it?
Sure.
That all those things are, you can go to the nth degree in acting, and it's a treasure. It's a treasure for me because it's really where I can explore my deepest self and my deepest truth, I feel like, safely.
Do you feel like you can kind of look back and see the parallels or reflections of what was going on in your personal life and maybe things that you were not able to take on in your emotional and personal life that you were able to kind of work through in with a particular job? Like, do you think of it that way? Do you sort of look back and go, oh, when I was making that movie or when I did that play?
I mean, sometimes I think that there were times where I often become a reflection of who I'm with.
Yeah.
And
it's so exciting at first, right? When you, I mean, just in terms of like when you're excited about someone and then you want to kind of.
But aren't you, I mean, I like myself better with certain people than I do with other
people.
For
sure. No question about it.
And I don't know what that is because it's still me, but there's certain people that draw out the best side of me and there's certain people that draw out the worst side of me.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, depending on how you're feeling about yourself, you're attracted to people that bring out the worst in you sometimes, because you're not sad, you're unhappy in yourself, and you can say, "Oh, see what a jerk I am."
God, you're so
see
right.
See what a jerk I am. I'll look what an asshole
yeah,
I am. You know,
you're so right.
And so it confirms your negative beliefs about yourself. But when you have when you're in a good sphere. And it's all out there. I mean, the good and the bad is like it's around us all the time. I always say to people, you know, if you walk around looking at your feet, that's what you're going to see is your shoes, you know. And if you hold your head up and you just look out, God, you don't even know what you're going to see, you know, and fabulous. And there's a lot of scary stuff to look at, but there's also some really great stuff to look at. And that's where you, I think, grow as a person. You know, it's you have to leave your safe place. And you have to have the courage to love yourself, because you should. Because why shouldn't you?
Yeah.
And if someone told you you shouldn't, they're wrong.
Oh.
I mean, that's for sure.
Yeah.
That's 100. And you might be doing bad things.
You probably would do them less if you loved yourself
and you
more.
You probably would do. Yeah. You probably. You know, it's like kids that vie for your attention by being little, you know, jerks. I mean, they're.
Yeah.
And you know. And it's because they, I mean, listen, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but it just makes sense that the more, it's like a circular thing. Mm-hmm. When you look out and you see new things come in, new things in yourself come forward, and you have more courage to go out. And to go back to the thing with choosing bad, you know, bad men, not bad men, but people that...
You chose
you live
to
in their
sort of,
shadow.
Yeah.
It's like that I always...
And you were reflecting their personalities or their needs or their...
Yeah. And I felt that was very... You know, I was with my wonderful husband, and we're not married anymore, but we learned a tremendous amount from each other. But it was ended up not being the right thing for either of us, finally.
And you were married once before that, right?
Or once
you,
before that.
Yeah.
For only a year and a half. My husband was killed in a motorcycle accident. In San Francisco. That was a classic 1968. We were going to go see Janis Joplin in Golden Gate Park.
Lynch.
It was really, yeah, it was quite a, I'm trying to write something about it. I've actually started a little screenplay that I'm not sure where it's going to go, but I'm going to someday finish it up and let somebody maybe help me with it in terms of story. Because the story, you still have to, as a screenplay, it's got to still have a good story. First act, second act, and third
act.
No matter how emotional you feel about what it is, it's still got to find that. But, yeah, his name was Marshall, and he was kind of the love of my life, I think. But we weren't doing good either. I mean, we got married we had a psychedelic wedding.
Oh, and this is awesome. Thank you so much for telling us about
this. West Haverstraw, New York, and we were married by a psychedelic priest who actually, I mean, he legally married us, but we also got married by a justice of the peace.
Uh-huh. Okay, when you say psychedelic wedding, let's give the younger ladies a sense of what that would include.
That's a pretty big
because they're probably picturing Austin Powers right now.
No. Well, no, it was, everybody was pretty loaded. But mostly just on, people smoked a lot of pot. And took a fair amount of acid. I mean, I was never, I can't do that much of any of it because I fall asleep no matter what it is.
I like that with
so
booze.
It's like, no matter what it is. This was.
And how old were you?
I was 23.
Okay.
And Marshall, I met him in college. We did a play called Bye Bye Birdie together.
Sure.
He played Conrad Birdie.
Oh, this is gorgeous.
And I played Ursula Merkel, the leader of the fan club.
Oh, this is great.
And he was this gawky, geeky guy. He looked like Buddy Holly, except a little homelier, with kind of freckles and big glasses. And he was real skinny. And he got this part because he played the guitar and actually could imitate Elvis Presley pretty good. And suddenly... He started working out, and he got contact lenses, and I just remember one day I walked into rehearsal, and it was like the classic, like, triple take.
Yeah.
I thought, wow.
That is wonderful.
And I completely fell head over heels in love with this guy, and I mean, I was wild about him for two full years in college, and It really is a great story. I don't know how much of it I should reveal, but and then I went to Europe when we graduated college, and he went to Alaska shrimp fishing, and then came to England to meet me. And
oh my God, it's just an epic romance already.
It was an epic romance. It was a true epic romance. And then we came back to Detroit, and we were living in sort of a commune in this crazy house, and in the inner city when the riots were on our lawn. We had snipers on our lawn one night. That was also
insane. Oh my
gosh. Yeah, it was crazy. But but before we got married, we decided he was in school in social work school at in Detroit, and I was living in New York. I was at Columbia.
Yeah.
And he would come visit, and we decided we were going to get married. And so we planned this wedding in upstate New York.
Pre or post Woodstock? Where are we?
It was, 68. It was probably just pre-Woodstock, I think.
And I'm going to call your wedding Woodstock 1 from now on. Woodstock. And Woodstock 2 was the Woodstock everyone knows. But you guys had Woodstock 1. It was a wedding.
And Marshall was he played the guitar, and I mean, we were all wild with all the great, there was the greatest music still ever then.
Yeah.
But so we decided to get married, and we weren't going to tell our families, and we were going to have our little private wedding up. We were going to get a justice of the peace, and I borrowed this girl's Mexican wedding dress that had a big spot on it. It was a little white.
Doesn't matter, man.
Dress,
doesn't
right,
matter.
Right, right, right. It was like, it was all good. My hair was really long down to my waist. And,
oh, wow.
And so Marshall, so we planned this. We were going to get married on Mother's Day. So suddenly Marshall's mother decided to surprise us. And she said she was coming to New York for Mother's Day. And we thought, what the hell are we going to do? So we thought, we got to invite her. We're not going to cancel the wedding. So then we thought, we have to call my parents.
Sure.
So we actually called. My mother didn't stop crying. My mother.
She didn't?
No.
She
was
23.
So upset. Doesn't matter. There's so much more to this whole story, but it's way too long to get into. But when the movie comes out, you'll see it all.
It is a movie. That's what I mean. Like,
a movie. It definitely is. It's definitely a great story.
It's not even a movie. It's a miniseries because we need time for each decade because so much amazing stuff was happening
in
your world.
That is kind of true in some respects. But anyway, so we realized we had to tell my parents. It was May 12th. There was a freak snowstorm in Detroit. My parents couldn't get out. The plane was canceled.
That is a freak snowstorm in May.
It was crazy. I mean, like a blizzard in Detroit. We went up to New York, and I remember I had a psychedelic sticker on my forehead and a dandelion necklace, nine yards.
Oh.
And we were staying in this house, and the justice of the peace, the psychedelic guy, married us the night before, and the next day was the wedding with the justice of the peace to make it really legal.
Yeah.
And that was when my parents couldn't get there in time. And the justice of the peace couldn't wait for them because he was taking his mother to Marie Callender's for lunch for Mother's Day. So he couldn't wait. So they missed the wedding.
Oh my gosh.
And of course, Marshall and I did nothing but fight. I mean, it was like a horrible, insane, crazy day.
Well,
yeah, it was not so much fun, actually. It was fraught with all kinds of tension, and our parents were here. His mother was a mess, and my mother was a mess, and my brother was trying to calm everybody down and trying to field the field. So we were married we moved to San Francisco, and I was working actually at the Metropolitan, at the San Francisco Museum of Art. I became the registrar, if you can
believe
it.
Oh, okay. Okay, so the San Francisco Museum of Art, is that, I'm trying to think.
It's the Contemporary Art Museum.
So is it MoMA, or is it, no, that's, it was pre-MoMA.
Museum
of Modern Art?
It's called the San Francisco Museum of Contemporary Art.
Okay. I'm trying to think if that's still.
It is still there.
Yeah. I feel ridiculous. I lived there for 10 years, and I don't think I ever went to the Contemporary Art Museum.
And they had fantastic photography exhibits. John Humphrey was his name. This guy who was the curator of photography. I did not know what a registrar was, and I applied since I had been an art history major at University of Michigan. When Marshall and I moved there, I applied. I sent three resumes. There was the DeYoung the Contemporary Art Museum, and there was one other one. And all three of them said, we're not taking any new people, you know, just send us your application. And so I was almost going to take a job as a proofreader, which is the biggest joke on the planet, because I don't know how to spell anything. But they had offered me this weird job, and then I get this call from the Museum of Contemporary Art, and saying that there was the registrar's position had opened up. Was I interested? So I said, "Oh, sure." So I kind of just talked my way in. I mean, this woman, her name was Sue Foley, and I wonder if she's still out there, because she was awesome. She was a curator, and she interviewed me. She was this tall, kind of very wonderful, just a wonderful person. And she kind of just, we hit it off. I mean, I was such a baby. I was at 23. I was like 12. I mean, I really was. I was just like such a baby. And she said, yeah, well, I think you'll be fine. I'll introduce you to Gerald Nordland was the, God, I remember all these
you,
names.
I know. I was going to comment on that. You are unbelievable with
and
names.
And Mr. Peterson ran the museum. He was this kind of sweet guy. And they all were they all were sort of endeared, I guess, the fact that I really was. I was like a baby, even though I was 23.
But I bet you were super enthusiastic.
I was super enthusiastic. Yeah. Yeah, that was true. And they said, yes, you'll be fine. Come tomorrow. I had no idea what a registrar did.
I'm not even sure I know what a registrar does.
Oh, my God.
Uh-oh.
OMG.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She all of a sudden opens up all these ledgers of insurance.
Oh, my gosh.
And incoming and outgoing exhibits and packing and things with the shipping.
So you're basically running the museum.
You are you are responsible for all the paintings that come in and out of the museum. All the photographs, all the sculpture with condition notes and oh my God, and if an insurance if things get chipped or something's wrong, or I mean it was a wild and big job.
Yes.
And I kind of just figured, you know, I mean Kathy was my sort of coworker. I can see these people clear as day. Kathy was married to, I don't think she had kids yet, but she also was kind of like, everybody was really young in the museum pretty much. And so I worked that while Marshall was trying to be a rock and roller. He was writing music, and they had a band in Detroit called the Spike Drivers.
Oh, I love it.
Which was actually a pretty good band. And
it's a great name.
Yeah, and it was, before Marshall got into it, the lead singer was Mary Carol Brown, and Sid Brown was her husband, who was the lead guitarist, and he was really, I mean, he could really play. He was a serious...
You can say he could shred.
He could shred. He really could. But they were a very interesting couple who we then lived with. Ugh, I mean, there's so much about all this. And,
oh, my gosh.
And then we lived with the bass player, with Sid and Mary Carol, and the bass player's wife, and everybody, all they did was fight. I mean, it was a lot of fighting in the 60s because everybody was...
Messed up. Yeah, not sleeping enough.
You know, but we were all macrobiotic. We were all eating a lot of brown rice and baking bread with seeds.
Yep,
and no yeast. I mean, we'd have this bread that was like a rock. Literally, you'd mix everything you could together, like nine kinds of flour and seeds and millet and mullet and muesli. I don't even know what happened. Everything started with an M.
Yep.
And sunflower seeds.
And just
seeds
have a basically like a...
Water. And you mix it and you make like a, literally like a rock. And you put it in the oven and you bake it until it's...
So heavy, right?
Oh, it would weigh like 8 pounds. You take this thing and then you cut it really thin and put tamari on it.
Oh, yes.
It was really good. But boy, did you, you know, it was quite a diet.
That's...
You're forget about being regular.
I was going to say.
It was like...
every 5 minutes. Regular anyway, and then some.
And then some. But,
That's great.
So that was part of that adventure. And I forgot what the question was.
Honestly, we were talking about Marshall, but that was all fantastic. Yeah. And we don't have to go into specifics on your loss and any of that.
It was it was a very simple, odd, one of those experiences where... He asked me to go. He had a motorcycle, a BMW, that we drove everywhere. We actually drove it once from Detroit to Boston. I mean, we lived on that bike. And everybody was always, you know, your parents, of course, are always. It was a beautiful, big BMW, a 650, I guess it was. And so we were living in this house with this is going to be in the story with this other couple. This wasn't with Sid and Mary Carroll. That was in Detroit. But when we came to California, we lived with this other couple. I don't remember what they did. They had a little baby who was like 2 or 3 who never stopped crying. I just remember that, this little kid. And Marshall was going to see his cousin who lived in San Francisco. And I was going to go. And then I didn't go because we were supposed to. I was making moccasins.
Lynn, I know, stop
it's really,
it.
It is truly, truly almost silly.
Stop
it's so
it.
Classic. I was making a pair of moccasins. And I said I wanted to finish the moccasins. So Marshall went by himself. And, you know, I would have been on the back of the bike. I mean,
God,
that's the other
Lynn.
Thing. And it got hit by a little truck. It was a very crazy. He wasn't going fast. No helmets. Yeah. No one wore helmets then.
Yeah.
And if he had worn a helmet, he would not have died. There's for sure. I mean, he hit his head. And
guys,
was,
I hope you're listening because yeah. that is still true. If you are out there riding a bicycle or a motorcycle without a helmet,
you
I'm
really
sorry,
gotta,
but you need to put one on.
Well, I mean, it's a law to wear it. Yeah. Now you can't even, you know, you'll get nailed completely. But,
yeah.
But
people still do that on their bikes and it makes
yeah,
me crazy.
Yeah, that's true. And this was really simple. There was a green light. Marshall was going through it and a car didn't see him and made a left turn, you know, was finishing up the turn and hit him. And there was a lot of, I can't even express.
To that. Have everything change so abruptly.
Yeah.
And so, I mean.
It's so surreal. The whole,
so
it's still surreal.
Surreal.
I mean, it still feels surreal.
We didn't really get into where you met Clayton. I think you were going to tell me that, but we decided that we would truncate it a little bit because all the stories are so good. And I can tell you, we might have to have a Lynn Shea part two because I have a feeling I'm going to get emails from people saying, "How dare you not tell me about going to meet Jack Nicholson?" But
that
I thought we could get into just very briefly about being a mom and sort of. What that experience was like for you and as particularly with a teenage boy, when it came to that.
I never really wanted kids. I was never one of the, my mom always would talk about, you know, when you have kids and when you, cause that was very traditional, again, part of that whole traditional family unit. And that's what women did is get married and have children. And it wasn't that I didn't want kids. It was sort of the same thing. I never envisioned myself as a mom or as a mother. And when I met Clayton, we met actually at a theater company out here called the Los Angeles Theater Unit. It was kind of a very circuitous way that we met each other. But a friend of his from Clayton was from upstate New York. There was a friend of his out here who was kind of this real go-getter, and he decided he was going to start a theater company, and he brought in some of his friends and asked me if I wanted to be a part of it, and of course I was always sure, let's do it, what should I do, how can I help, and blah, 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 blah. So I met Clayton at the first meeting we had of the Los Angeles Theater Unit, and we ended up actually having a company for 10 years in downtown. We started out in downtown Los Angeles. The Embassy Hotel, which I don't know if that still exists, but they had a space that was a chapel.
Mm-hmm.
And we literally, or it was next door to a chapel. I can't remember exactly, but it was one of those, we turned it into a theater. We, you know, we brought paint and buckets and flats and
love it
and curtains and let's get music and have a musical.
Yeah. You know?
So we wrote the first piece we did was called American Gothic and it was very successful. It was all based on improv stuff we did. And Clayton and I played husband and wife, a 60s couple, so to speak. And we, like Clayton used to say, we went home to improv one day, and that was sort of the end of it. We started seeing each other, and this was 1982. And we dated, went out, whatever. And then we ended up moving in together. And we were together for 6 years and really never thought about getting married. And Clayton always talked about wanting kids.
Mm-hmm.
And he always had this kind of fantasy of wanting 2 sons. And so I, you know, was like, yeah, right, okay, fine. And we were at a Christmas party. And Clayton was talking to a friend of ours and said, yeah, so, because she said, what are you doing New Year's? And he said, well, I thought we would probably go like to either Reno or Vegas and get married. And he's talking to her, not to me.
This is how you find out.
And I'm kind of going, what the?
Yeah.
OMFG. And I remember her name was Claire. She kind of looked at me and I kind of looked at her and we were both like, what?
Okay.
And Claire said, I'm going to go get an hors d'oeuvre. So she walked off and I didn't say another thing. And when we got back to the house, I asked him if he was serious and he said, yeah, I kind of thought, because he was the one that had really, or not, no, both of us had just, we didn't really want to get married. And
right.
So we said, yeah, I was thinking about it. And I remember I said, well, if you're asking me if we should, I don't know the answer. If you're asking me if I would, the answer is yes.
Love it.
And so we made plans.
That goes in the screenplay.
Yeah, right.
It's a great line.
So we went to Reno, actually. We flew to Reno and we got married in one of the chapels on New Year's Eve. And Clayton was talking about, he kept talking about, actually he was talking about getting pregnant before that. And maybe that was one of the reasons that he thought about getting married. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, I'm not going to be a science experiment because that's just not my thing. And I said, but if I'll give it 6 months and if I get pregnant, great. And if I don't, I'm done. You know, mm-hmm. we're done. So he said, okay. And we had planned a trip to the Grand Canyon, a whitewater trip. And I had never rafted before. And Clayton was really into it. I had no idea what I was in for. Because, first of all, the Grand Canyon is, the rapids go up to 10. It's usually 1 through 5.
Oh, my God. That's hardcore.
This is 1 through 10.
Yay.
It was a private trip planned with, which I was thrilled to hear, a fireman was going.
Helpful. That's helpful. Go.
I thought, good, there's going to be
in
a
case
fireman.
Of emergency.
Are we having doctors also? Uh-huh. Or lawyers? Is there a doctors, lawyers, firemen? And then we had, and there were a lot of tour guys who were guides who were used to go down the river and take groups. So I did feel pretty safe that we were with people that at least knew what they were doing. And I remember asking this doctor if, as I said, we're going on this really rough, because Clayton said, we're going to get pregnant on this trip. And I said, yeah, right. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
So then I said to the doctor, he said, for 14 days, the first 14 days, you don't have to worry about anything. He said, but starting day 15, that's the date the egg implants into the uterus.
Okay.
And he said, that's when you need to take it a little bit easy, mm-hmm. because if you're too active or you don't give the egg a chance. So, we were actually away 14 days to the day, and I got pregnant the first night we were
on
the river. We were in Superior, Arizona. We were on our way to Flagstaff.
Yeah, where I went to college.
Which is also a long story, but I won't digress here. but anyway, I ended up getting pregnant, and day 15, and I knew, I had a feeling I was pregnant.
Interesting. And even it's so amazing.
Oh, I had a feeling the next morning.
It's amazing.
I just, everything, I was dizzy and I couldn't stand up and I thought, no way. And I didn't even say anything to Clayton. But anyway, we got back to LA and we had been renting a house and I took the test and I was pregnant. So, and it was day 15, literally.
Wow.
And I was an older mom. You can look on IMDb if you have to. But I don't have to be. I was 44 when I got pregnant.
That's fantastic. And not that uncommon now.
No, it's not, of course. But what was kind of uncommon is that it was the first time we had ever tried to get
pregnant.
That's
amazing.
And
as you had said, I'll give it 6 months.
Yeah, and everybody was like, you can forget about it pretty much. And actually, we were very, very, very lucky even now.
Agreed.
And we, I had the most wonderful pregnancy. I loved being pregnant.
That's always good for me to hear.
Oh, I just loved it. I loved everything about it. I didn't have terrible morning sickness because I guess that's pretty debilitating.
Yeah.
I had indigestion a lot, which they say sometimes means it's a boy, and I do have a son, but I didn't have, I wasn't sick a lot, so, and I felt great. I mean, and I loved all the changes. And
yeah, my mom did too. I have hope.
It's really, I mean, don't let anybody scare you. You don't get fat, and you don't get, it's like, just get over it. Enjoy what's going on.
Yeah.
It's truly it is truly the most miraculous of miracles still, and yeah. that all happens. And watching now the ultrasounds are so sophisticated, you know, they're almost like drawings. I mean,
yeah.
But I remember when I went to the doctor and they showed me it's a pinpoint, literally, that where the egg is started in the wow. where the sac is in the very beginning, and I was very. I did what they call a CVS, is it? I think it's called, which is an early detection. It wasn't the amnio, which is at 5 months already.
Right.
I was very clear that if something was wrong, I was not going to have the baby.
Yeah.
And I know that's a lot of people, you know, that's a very controversial statement and a very controversial element of pregnancy. But I know my own capacity.
Yeah.
I believe that, you know, that you have the right to make the choice, most certainly. It's your body. It's your life. And fortunately, they have testing where you really can pretty much tell what's going on. And everything was normal. I did have one scare, though. I went to be tested for gestational diabetes, which is one of the things they test you for. And I came up through the roof, diabetic. And I thought, oh, my God, what do I have to do? And it turns out the woman had given me twice the concentration.
Oh, hello.
Because it was so high, the woman said, let's do this one more time just to be sure, because you are off the chart. Because they give you like this Coca-Cola syrup to drink or something. And she had given me literally twice the amount. And it came
back perfectly averted.
Normal. Oh, God. So that was a big relief. And I had I was very excited, and even the delivery was pretty exciting. I was in labor a very long time because my son is what they call a sunny side up baby, which means he's head down, but he's lying on his back.
Okay,
and there's a turn like a baby dolphin that the baby makes at the end to kind of push itself out. It kind of spins out of the, which makes you dilate fully and, you know, be able to deliver the baby.
Yeah.
Well, this is a trait my son still has. He just lay on his back waiting for somebody to get him. And so I ended up with a C-section after 3 days of labor.
Whoa.
Which was pretty intense. But you know what? You're on another planet.
Right.
It could have been 12 days for all I knew. I had no idea what was going on, period, by the end of everything. And
you had a psychedelic birth in a way.
I had a psychedelic birth.
Just from the hormones.
But I had a very healthy, beautiful little boy who was eight pounds, half ounce. And the best part of our marriage was when Lee was born. I must say for Clayton, he was the best dad and the best husband I could ever, ever want or imagine. And it was really fun. But anyway, so I loved being a mom. It's very mind and body altering. The hormones is pretty intense. Yeah. It is for everybody. I mean, it's, I was scared to leave the hospital. I didn't remember that. Because I had never even held a newborn. I had no idea anything. And that first night coming home with this baby is really out of this world, literally.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, what do we do now?
Yeah.
You know, and they sort of are, it's a very demanding situation. I won't sugarcoat it. It's, you got to be ready to do it. You got to be very patient. And hopefully, a woman that does it alone with no partner, it wouldn't be something I would want to do.
Yeah.
If you have to, you do, I suppose, you know, but there is something of the bonding and the value of that family unit, which still is a very important element in sort of the journey of life. I mean, things are so different now than it used to. Like when my mom, going back to what we talked about in the 50s, family units are completely different than they used to be. The blended family and the people with two marriages and four stepchildren and two fathers and six mothers. But this was really, we were really a very traditional family. My mom and dad stayed married their whole life. I actually thought I would stay married my whole life. I was a lifer. I had no things sometimes get difficult because communication is difficult. Having a child is difficult in terms of the change it makes in your priorities and in the way you interact with each other, too.
Sure.
It takes a lot of flexibility and trust in your partner. And I can't not emphasize enough communication. I mean, if you've never been a communicator before, you better become one when you have a child. Because nobody grows correctly if you don't. Not the kid, not you, not your marriage, not your husband. That you really, really... And I think the value of the partnership is really what becomes so essential at that point.
Yeah.
And because... It's hard to feel sexy. It's hard to feel focused. It's hard to feel hard to remember.
Yeah,
mostly anything. except that the baby's crying, and what are we gonna do?
Sure.
But it is a tremendously worthwhile journey. I feel like even though I never really wanted children, that my son has been the biggest part of my education as a woman. I've learned and grown more because of what I learned to have to do with him, for him, from him, than any other thing that could have. And there's nothing else that would have provided me with that. And it's interesting that it's the ultimate selfish journey. People think, oh, I can't give up my freedom. I can't give up myself. And yeah, we're all a little selfish, whatever. But the ultimate selfish thing is to have a child, because that's how you really fulfill your own destiny, I think, on some level. You really learn about yourself as a woman. You learn about yourself as a friend. You learn about yourself as an educator. You learn about yourself as a communicator. You learn about yourself as a person, as a mom. You really learn what that word means of nurturing and caring for somebody, which then makes you care for yourself in a different way. And it's really... I can honestly say it's probably the best thing I've ever done in my life. And I went in kicking and screaming pretty much. And if you don't have kids, hey, there's a lot of ways to fulfill yourself in life. And I'm not saying you're any less of a woman or a complete person without children, because that's wrong. But I think
that was your experience.
But that was my experience. And for me in particular, who was such a baby and so afraid I couldn't take care of something. I actually was full of fear of not having the ability to take care of something. I remember a dream I had of a baby. I had a baby, and the baby was transparent. You could see all its organs. I mean, this was really a crazy dream. And I remember trying to feed the baby, and I couldn't feed it, and it was crying and crying and crying, and the baby exploded in the dream.
No.
Exploded.
Oh, that's horrifying.
It was a horrifying dream. And I'll never forget that dream. But it was really me being afraid. I mean, because they say your dreams, figure out your own dreams. No one can, you know what they mean. You just keep asking yourself enough questions about what it is and you'll figure out the answer. Well, this was so perfectly clear. And I remember I got a little kitten that I had never thought I could take care of something. I picked out a little kitten from the pound, sort of, which that's another long story, but it was like 3 inches long. I thought rodent that they had put in the cage for the kittens to play with.
Oh, no!
Yeah. And I took this little thing home. It sat in my hand like a mouse.
Whoa.
And I nursed, for 6 weeks, six times a day, I fed this little thing. It was like the most intensive experience I've ever had. And Caboodle, which was her name, lived to be 18 years old.
Oh, Caboodle.
And I did it. And I thought, what if she had died?
Yeah.
You know, would I have had a child?
So interesting. And I want to also add, and I can't, we've run out of time and I'm furious, but I also want to add that you are, you know, we've talked about all this and all this idea of running scared a little bit from the caregiving and stuff, and yet you have horses and you have dogs and you have cats
and
you have a son.
And I'm the ultimate caregiver.
And you're the ultimate caregiver and you're beloved by all of these creatures.
Yeah.
So you really came around to it. So for someone who has that identification with what it's like to feel on the outside, it's really hard not to see that you have that, but you also are so intrinsically tied to to all of these creatures, that human and non-human, that are your family too.
And I think it's when I was little, everything was done for me. I mean, I you know, as I said, it wasn't about being rich and, you know, all that stuff. It was about, I mean, we were comfortable. We were a comfortable family. My mom had, we had a, you know, we had she wasn't a nanny, but we had like a housekeeper who was there regularly. And, but I never was given any real responsibility. And that was where my parents fell down a little bit. And so consequently, I still don't know how to do probably a lot of the things I have fear of new thing, of trying to do something new some of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's only when I'm thrust into something or it's thrust upon me that I realize I can actually figure out how to do a mortgage and how to do.
Well, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like you have to, you know, but until it's kind of pushed on you, you know, I'd rather somebody else do it, to tell you the truth.
Sure.
But I now, and the irony is now being on my own, nothing happens unless I do it. Nothing. Yeah. And so from being this person who was afraid to do stuff, I still, the sense of satisfaction you get of feeling like you've accomplished something and learned something is phenomenal. And I guess raising a child is the ultimate of that.
Yeah. You know, Lynn Shay, you've been such an amazing guest. I really seriously wish that I had like a whole mini series that I could do of Lynn Shay podcasts. Thank you so much. You're so inspiring.
Oh, you should see who's sitting across from me, Lil Jan.
Oh gosh. I was telling I podcasted my friend June last week, and I said I'm getting nervous that people are just going to write in and say you're just brown nosing these women, but there's a reason that they're on the podcast, and it's because they're amazing. And guys, I'm not going to lie to you, this is a really great way for me to stay connected to them and be inspired by them and learn from them. So hopefully you feel the same way, and you'll forgive me for being so gushy about people like Lynn Shay. But thanks for tuning in, and
thanks for listening. Thank you, Janet.
Thank you so much, Lynn. And I always say we'll see you next time on the podcast. You won't see me at all. This is audio. Please enjoy all of Lynn's amazing work, and there will be much more to come. Okay, thanks. As always, the JV Club theme song is Before We Were Brittle, courtesy of the amazing Say Hi.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.